Are you craving incredible song recitals? Are you interested in a behind-the-scenes view into professional songmaking at the highest levels of artistry? Are you looking to develop your own artistic and entrepreneurial skills as a classical musician in this ever-changing 21st century landscape? If you found yourself saying yes to any of those questions, look no further than Cincinnati Song Initiative's week-long program, The Fellowship of the Song. Taking place this year from May 19 through 26, the Fellowship brings together some of the country's brightest song performers and teachers for a week of classes, concerts, and study events. And we invite you to join us as an auditor, either in person in Cincinnati or online wherever you may be located. When you join the Fellowship as an auditor, you gain instant access to the entire week's events and can go back and relive the magic through HD video recordings of each and every session. To learn more about this incredible new opportunity, visit CincinnatiSongInitiative.org/audit.
And welcome to Follow the Leader with me, your host, Mandy Madrid Sikich. If you are a fan of the podcast, remember to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen. And remember, if you like what we are doing on the podcast, tell your friends. And if you don't, then tell your enemies, because as I like to say, any publicity is good publicity. Today, we are joined by my dear friend, Janie, and actually, what is your name? I was thinking about this, I was like, I actually don't know legally what her name is.
It's a fair question. Last name is Roy, for now. We may make the change, but...
Okay. But so you do go it, by legally Janie Roy, is
yes,
it?
Yes, I do. That's fantastic. I could just shorten it and just be first name. We're just Janie.
Just Janie, like Cher, Madonna.
Exactly.
Yeah, so could you maybe tell the listeners a little bit about yourself?
Yes, would love to. I'm really excited to be here. I'm excited to geek out over music. That was actually the first thing that I went to school for. I've always loved being a student. No surprise that I went back a time or two. But yeah, I studied music the first time around, psychology the second time around. So those two things combined together. Any chance to dive into a piece and talk about it and learn about it, this is like right up my alley. So yeah, hobbyist now, but that's a little bit about why this is interesting to me.
As opposed to Brian, I kind of have to kidnap him and like hold him hostage and force him into the backseat of the sofa. You're a willing participant today.
I'm a willing participant.
Yeah, I was thinking you were actually there when the idea for this podcast was born.
Was I?
Yes, I was sitting at the picnic table at our campsite in Sedona with Deborah, and I was telling her about the song that first year in Sedona. That's where this was born.
I have the picture proof.
Yes, you took the picture.
Such a vivid memory for me.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think it's really cool, and I'm like so excited for that reason specifically. I'm really excited that you're here today.
Full circle moment.
So today we're going to talk about the composer who wrote this. That's it. That's all you have to listen to.
Climax. It's just this wavy trudge to the top and then meltdown.
We have Brian Sikich to thank for that, because I did not know that there was a fail of that.
It is so perfect.
We're talking about the composer who wrote that. And I think most non-classical music people associate that with 2001 A Space Odyssey, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's who we're talking about today. We are talking about Richard Strauss, who wrote that fabulous, theme in Also sprach Zarathustra, which we know, obviously. I mean, it's iconic soundtrack now, right? And we now know, did you see the Barbie movie? It was used in that opening. We're also going to be speaking about his song Alle Seelen, which you will see is very fitting for this time of year. Also, just a quick mention, I could keep trying to say Strauss the whole time, but I'm just going to say Strauss, okay?
That's cool.
So do you know anything about Strauss?
Not that I would bank on.
Wonderful. Okay, so this is going to be great. So what we'll do is I'm going to tell you a bit of biographical info so you can know a little bit about the man himself, and then we'll talk about the text and the song for the day, okay?
Fantastic. Okay.
So Richard Strauss was born on June 11th, 1864 in Munich, Germany, and he was truly one of the most influential and celebrated composers and conductors of the late Romantic and early 20th century era. He was honestly the most successful composer of his time. You know, we often have this idea that composers were these, you know, wretched, tortured creatures.
Absolutely.
That were like suffering for their art. But this was not, for the most part, this was not the case for Strauss. So I think often, you know, composers historically have really derived a creative spark from struggle or from personal tragedy, but Strauss was not the kind of composer that indulged that. He was very disciplined and he prioritized order and stability, and he didn't see those kinds of things as obstacles, but that they were actually things that would compel him and enable his creative process when he had the time and the space to really work out ideas that were important to him.
That's really fascinating to me, because you're right. There's this like starving artist, and that becomes like, oh, I write because I'm in pain or whatever. And to have someone who's like, I am fine and I love order and I love structure and my days look like this, and this is why I write these beautiful things. That's really fascinating. And hats off to him, because I kind of think that there might be like some kind of pressure as an artist. I can imagine like feeling the need to drum up, like, what's my villain origin story?
Totally. I mean, it was something I found quite fascinating about him as a character and as a working composer. As opposed to, one of his friends was the composer, Gustav Mahler. And Mahler was a pretty tortured individual. And he had this idea that he needed to seek some sort of redemption and try to do that through composing. And Strauss always really wondered about this preoccupation of Mahler's with redemption. And Strauss said, I don't know what I'm supposed to be redeemed from. When I sit at my desk in the morning and an idea comes into my head, I surely don't need redemption.
That is so funny to me. So he's on this one end going like, looking at the tortured artist going, what's the deal?
Which is funny, because on the one hand, I think that that is an aspect of him having had a privileged life. So he really did have, I would say up until about the First World War, he had a great life and didn't experience as much suffering and tragedy as maybe some others. Although ultimately he was not entirely untouched by misfortune, which we'll get into a little bit later. It just wasn't the most important catalyst in composition for him as it might have been for others. And there are definitely some pieces he wrote, like his very famous Metamorphosen for strings that was really written during like the darkest days of World War II. And you can hear it's really a lament. I think what probably his most emotional work. So it's not to say that didn't exist for him, but not to the same degree or level, I think, for others. So let me tell you a little bit about his, you know, kind of privileged background. He was born into a musical family, and not just, you know, that there was music around, but that his father was a successful professional musician. His father, Franz Josef Strauss, was a well-known and well-connected horn player and played in the orchestra for many of Wagner's opera premieres.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And it's funny because actually Father Strauss did not approve of Wagner's music. He was really conservative. He, you know, really put on a pedestal all the more conservative composers. He thought that after Mendelssohn, music just went downhill.
Oh my goodness, that's so funny.
And so while he played in these orchestras and was very successful doing that, he didn't let his son listen to Wagner. The young Richard was not allowed to indulge in studying Wagner's music, which is funny because Wagner ended up, of course, you know, as the child individuates from the parent, they seek out that which has been forbidden. And that was definitely the case with the young Strauss. Oh, yeah. Do you know anything about Wagner?
I recognize Wagner. I recognize like his works. Mm-hmm. I recognize his operas. I've seen some of them. Okay. That's about
it. Oh, you have? Wow. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's a lot more than I think just the random person on the street.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it helped that like we were required to go and see some things. And then being close to, you know, in Los Angeles, like having access to those things made it a little bit easier. But
well, and, you know, props for going to a Wagner opera. Even I steer clear of Wagner opera. I don't know. By hour three, I'm just sitting there thinking, you know what? I'm ready for this to be done.
Sure.
So let's get into it a bit. In terms of style, Strauss was considered to be the successor in many ways to both Wagner and Brahms, which is really saying something because at the time, the Wagner and Brahms battle was deeply raging. So Wagner was known for a more innovative approach to music, particularly this development of the Gesamtkunstwerk, the total work of art concept, in which he sought to unite, you know, all these different elements. So music, drama, poetry, visual arts. It was all supposed to be this singular experience, okay?
And I do love
the music was a bit more abstract, and he was pushing the boundaries of tonality and chromaticism. Brahms, on the other hand, was a conservative composer who more adhered to, you know, traditional forms, traditional structures of classical music. So,
okay, so you're sparking my memory a little bit. I do remember, like, when you said Wagner, I was like, oh, there was a small time that I remember being obsessed with, like, this idea. And I'm remembering why now, because of that whole, like, conceptual approach. Like, in growing up, I wish, like, when we're born, we come with, like, this little manual to understand ourselves, but we don't, so we find this out along the way. But one of the things that I found out along the way is that, like, I think very conceptually. So when I was learning about Wagner and that whole approach to, like, this is all one cohesive piece and we're communicating through, like, the visual and the music and the themes and, like, the tonality and the chaos, and it's all, like, one ball of concept, and yes. I just, before I even understood why, thought that was like the coolest thing.
Right. And Strauss really latched on to, I think, some elements within that. But it is very fascinating that he would be considered a successor to both Wagner and Brahms.
Two sides of the spectrum.
Right, right. In general, I think Strauss was a little bit more toned down from Wagner. And he was often going for a shock factor. In fact, it was a criticism of him at the time that, you know, many critics thought that Strauss was just trying to create a sensation as much as possible. But there was this element of the fact that he understood that music, while he was an artist and he wanted to create art, he also understood that music was a commodity. And so if he could wield that as a money-making device, he wouldn't lower his standards necessarily, but I think he was very aware of the shock value and the sensation that his music created. And again, it was the same with Wagner. Wagner was very aware that his music was pushing the boundaries and making people uncomfortable and creating this rift, you know, between these two polarized factions. In general, Strauss really had a knack for things working out for him. So, you know, he started composing, and because of this background and his father's connections, he just had the means to be able to get his work into the hands of different people. And actually, it's kind of funny, even the first time he ever conducted, his mentor, Hans von Bülow, put a baton in his hand and told him to conduct his own composition on the condition that he conduct without rehearsal. So he just had to get up there And the first time he was going to be conducting was on stage in front of an audience, and it worked out.
What? Stop the pressure.
Yeah, so Strauss was working under this mentor, and von Bülow really liked to set up tests for him like this because he could see that Strauss was truly talented. It wasn't just, oh, here's a kid whose dad has, you know, some money and some connections, and so we're giving him jobs. No, he was truly, wow. Truly talented, truly skilled. And also, he was a really hard worker. He was famous for having such an intense schedule and being pulled in so many different directions. It was said he had a prodigious energy. And there were jokes that he must have had a secret twin somewhere because he was always doing so much all the time many different directions. Yeah, that they were like, this just can't be one little guy. There's got to be two of them.
He's got a double.
So we're here today to talk specifically about one of his songs. His wife was actually the first main performer of his songs. So her name was Pauline. She came to him actually as a pupil. They ended up falling in love, as teachers and students sometimes tend to do. They got married. They toured all over. And the interesting thing about this little duo is that she was a really dominating personality and was pretty notorious for being just over the top, very eccentric, very outspoken. And as time went on, as they did more and more tours, like, you know, throughout the decades, her dresses became more and more voluminous. Her scarves and fans were just way over the top.
Because she can.
Because she, yeah. Mm-hmm, yeah. Definitely. I mean, she was the star. And also, her husband was this wildly successful composer, so why not?
What a life.
He was a celebrity conductor, and so she was this celebrity wife who also, you know, had a great talent. She inspired much of his work. Much of his output is written specifically for the soprano voice or a high voice. And actually, after he met her, there was this great outpouring of song that he composed. And naturally, we, you know, think that it was because she inspired. She was his sort of muse. As time went on and her demeanor just became more and more ostentatious. There were even times where on stage, she would finish her part of the song, right? And there'd be a piano postlude and he'd be accompanying her on stage, but she would expect the audience to begin clapping as soon as her part was done. So like essentially clapping over the piano postlude. And sometimes she would even walk over and cover up Strauss from view. Couldn't see him.
What a force of a woman. This is my life. This is my time.
The audacity to just really take it all the glory.
Oh my gosh.
Unfortunately, we don't have any recordings of them performing together, which I think would just be so
That would be so cool. Yeah.
It's my dream that there is some recording somewhere that exists and it just hasn't been found yet.
Hiding in someone's library.
Yeah, yeah. So she inspired him and he wrote a lot of songs that are for high voices. And also he wrote a lot of operas with important soprano roles. So speaking of opera, this is where his career really took off. So he had some successful tone poems, which we'll probably talk a little bit more about in another episode. But do you know the story of Salome from the Bible? Or
yes.
I remember growing up hearing it, Salome.
100%. When you said the name at first, I was like, that sounds kind of, oh yeah, no, that's how you say it.
Salome. Oscar Wilde actually wrote a play based on the story of Salome, and Strauss wrote an opera using the German translation of the play. And this opera, let me tell you, it's wild, outrageously over the top, and especially for the time, he was able to encapsulate just this sensuality, this like sexual perversion he was able to incorporate into his music. And you know, well, the tone poems had been daring and adventurous. No one had really seen anything quite like this. Salome is absolutely hair-raising. And it was after this opera that he became known as the most advanced and interesting composer in Germany.
Ooh.
Yeah. And actually, at the premiere, all of the performers had to do 38 curtain calls. That's how successful it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. 38?
People went wild. Gustav Mahler, his friend, described it as a live volcano, a subterranean fire.
Ooh, these reviews, that's high praise.
Yeah, it was really cool. So after the success, he was able to build his dream house, which, by the way, Strauss's number one goal in life was to be able to make enough money so that he could live in his remote house away from people and work only on creative projects that he wanted to work on. And I don't think I've ever found a composer more relatable than this.
Absolutely. You were going on and I thought, oh, goals. That is ideal.
Which is interesting because, you know, he was a paradox of a man, right? So he was this international figure, this celebrity conductor, composer. People were always clamoring for him, and he knew that he had to do this work. And he willingly did it, and he used it to become rich. He wanted to become rich so that he could go be alone in his house in isolation.
Please afford me the chance to go back by myself.
Yes. So Strauss experienced great success up through the First World War, but a few things happened that really ended up bringing him into a period of decline. One was that after the First World War, all of his assets were frozen by England. So everything that he had worked so hard for, you know, everything that he had spent all this energy on, it was gone. And then also, as music moves on, which it does, he just couldn't keep up. The tastes were changing. Composers like Schoenberg and Berg were taking a tonality and running with it. And Strauss, while he pushed, you know, tonality to the limits, and a few of his operas in particular are very chromatic, he never really got into the atonal world that some of these other composers, I think it was the Viennese School of Music, this group of three, Schoenberg, Berg, and Webern, if memory serves. He couldn't keep up with this. And he spent a great deal of energy longing for a return, you know, to when he was at the pinnacle, when he was, you know, at his zenith.
What a story arc. He walked so they could run, and then he couldn't quite keep up. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just not the way the world works, right? And we see this at an even an exponentially faster rate these days. The trends in music, in film, just in art, it really does. It moves so fast, and you could be at your top of your game 1 year, and literally the next year you're out because things have moved on. It's just the way the world works. I also wanted to touch a little bit on the most controversial aspect of Strauss's life, which was his position as the president of the Reichsmusikkammer, which was the Chamber of Music of the Third Reich.
Oh.
Right. So he accepted this position. The Chamber of Music was basically around to promote good German music, you know, music by Aryans that upheld Nazi ideals. So Strauss himself was very apolitical. He took this position, and there's been some debate through the years over whether he was forced to take this position or whether he willingly took it. I read this pretty interesting article, I'll link to it in the show notes, about how he wasn't sort of forced at gunpoint to take this position, but he did use it to do some good. So while it was controversial, his daughter-in-law was actually Jewish.
Oh,
and so
wow.
his grandsons were Jewish, and he was able to save their lives.
Wow.
He was able, to arrange for them to be put in house arrest versus going to concentration camp. And actually, one time when he left town, they were abducted. They were kidnapped and taken and spent like 2 nights in a jail somewhere. And he was able to go talk his way into being able to take them home and have them put back under house arrest. Also, I think it was the grandmother of his daughter-in-law. She was sent to Theresienstadt, the concentration camp, which we actually covered in an episode of the podcast where we discussed Ilse Weber, a Jewish composer in Theresienstadt. So his daughter-in-law's grandmother went there, and he was able to get her out of the concentration camp, but there were other members of the family that he wasn't able to save. But he was pretty relentless in using his position to write letters and do as much as he could to help, you know, those Jewish people, musicians and otherwise, family members, friends. So that was a great way of that he was able to leverage his position to help out. And also, he worked really hard to preserve performances of composers that had been banned. He worked really hard to continue conducting and performing Mahler and Mendelssohn. Debussy was another one who was banned at the time.
That's, I mean, it was kind of a left turn, like, to hear that pop up in his life, but for him to use that and really turn his efforts into, like, preserving, helping. That's really fascinating.
Yeah. There's been some critique that he was also using it for personal advantage because he fought a lot for composers' rights and copyright laws. Mm-hmm. And some people say, well, he was really just trying to make sure that this would, you know, reinforce the fortune because he could earn royalties if copyright laws lasted longer. And I do think that that element was there. But actually, Goebbels said about him, because he was the one who had... I believe he was the one. Someone might want to fact check me on this. Goebbels was the one who hired him. But he wrote, I forget who he was writing to, but he was writing to someone about Strauss and said, unfortunately, we still need him. But one day we shall have our own music and then we shall have no further need of this decadent neurotic.
Okay.
So I think they were using Strauss. Now, Strauss was using this position, but they were also using Strauss and his celebrity status to further their cause. So, you know, this kind of mutually beneficial arrangement, which is, it just feels yucky now, you know, looking back in posterity.
And it feels really muddy.
Well, and he was also just extremely naive, and there's no excuse for naivete or ignorance, but he genuinely thought there was this... quote I remember reading where he said that the Germans can't eliminate all the Jews because then what would the concert houses do? What would any of these think? We need the Jews in music. They hold up the music industry. Mm-hmm. And he was just really, really out of touch. The fact that he could believe that so vehemently and not see what was happening right in front of him.
Wow.
You know, he refused to change librettists. He worked with his Jewish librettist, Stefan Zweig, and he actually wrote to Zweig in a letter. He said, "Do you believe I am ever in any of my actions guided by the thought that I am German? Do you suppose Mozart was consciously Aryan when he composed? I recognize only two types of people, those who have talent and those who have none." So it was this specific letter that was actually intercepted and used to facilitate his firing. So he lost that position.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And after the end of the war, Strauss was held by the Allies for a few weeks before being cleared of any wrongdoing or collaboration with the Nazis. You know, it's a challenging aspect about his life to talk about, but it is something that's there. We'll probably get into it a little bit more in a future episode, but I really felt like I couldn't introduce Strauss to the podcast at all and not mention that element. So World War II really decimated his fortune. He ended up moving to a hotel with his wife in Switzerland, and he was like copying out arrangements of his own work to try to earn royalties from it. He was taking gigs that he wouldn't have otherwise have taken, even braved boarding an airplane to go on a short 3-week tour in his I think he was in his 80s at that point, just to make some much needed cash. So, you know, this was a far cry from the dream life he had imagined for himself. And I mean, he had the great privilege of living to an old age, which is wonderful. But at the same time, there are difficulties that go along with that. This inability, I think humans in general do have a hard time adapting to change, especially when you reach such a successful, when you're just at the top and then stuff changes and you're not a part of it. I think it's great for reflection for myself to take that as a lesson, you know, to really take stock and look around. Okay, what have I dug my heels into? What has changed? What do I need to change? And to keep changing with it, because the only constant is change, right?
Yeah. It's so true. And learning how to, when you hit your highs, be there for them and also adjust and not waste a lot of time like clawing back for them. But how do I participate if my life changes? Or how do I participate if I'm not flying high in this moment? How do I participate when the world changes around me and my circumstances are different? How do I not become like a tragedy in my 70s?
Totally, totally. Well, and listen, the great news for me is that I'm not any kind of celebrity, so it's pretty easy to change and not have everyone watching me. I can really fuck this up and no one's going to care.
The sets of eyes that are on my life, I'm like counting them on my hands. Okay, we're good.
Okay, so let's turn to our song for the day. We're going to be talking about Alle Seelen, which translates as All Souls Day, which was yesterday. Okay. Yeah. Now, Strauss stressed the significance of Wagner, right? He stressed the significance that Wagner held for his own compositional work, which is interesting because Wagner actually completely neglected Lieder in general. He only wrote the Wesendonklieder, and that's it. Whereas Strauss continually returned to song throughout his life. A song was the first thing he wrote when he was 6 years old. And the four last songs were some of the last works that they're literally prophetically entitled Vier letzte Lieder, four last songs. And there was a fifth unfinished song on his desk when he died.
Wow.
Yeah. What's interesting is that this composition of Lieder and Strauss's life seems to be somewhat removed from a lot of what was going on in his personal life. In this book I was reading, which I'll link to in the show notes, he was saying how there was really no tell in the songs composed around the time of the wars or anything dramatic that was going on. There's no tell in his songs that that's what was going on in Strauss's life. They seem to be somewhat remote from events that were happening at the time, which I find fascinating.
It kind of makes sense with how you described how he operated, right? He loves the structure. He loves the, what do I need to be redeemed from? It's just this completely separate thing he's dealing with aside from reality.
Right. Yeah. And I loved it. He had this one, he said at one point, he described it when he would go looking for a song text to set, he would just open up a book of poems and just kind of flip through and whatever it flopped to, if that sort of matched with this idea that he had had in his mind for something, he would just choose that one.
Okay, well.
Also, he set a lot of his contemporaries, and he didn't really prioritize one poet over another. He just kind of whatever was working, you know, whatever was popular that year, like, okay, I'll set that. And many composers have been criticized for their lack of discernment in setting poems.
Sure.
You know, I have a really hard time criticizing poetry, and I'm not fluent in German. What I will say is I love the poem that we're talking about today, and I love the setting. It was actually the first German poem that I ever memorized myself.
Oh, wow.
I just sent you an email.
Okay.
And it has the English translation of the text. So I'll go ahead and read that now. Set on the table the fragrant mignonettes. Bring in the last red asters and let us talk of love again, as once in May. Give me your hand to press in secret, and if people see, I do not care. Give me but one of your sweet glances, as once in May. Each grave today has flowers and is fragrant. One day each year is devoted to the dead. Come to my heart and so be mine again, as once in May.
That's lovely.
Yeah, it really is. So I'm going to be honest. When I first learned this, I only read this poem one way. I read it as someone talking to a deceased loved one, to a deceased partner, essentially.
That's 100% what came to my head. The as once in May was a May in a year past that he's remembering. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. And this time when I came to it, I was reading about some alternative perspectives where perhaps it's someone simply talking to a loved one, someone that they've fallen out of relationship with. Mm. So they're taking advantage of the fact that it's All Souls Day to reignite an old flame.
Oh, which I can see this.
Yeah, which is funny because, to be perfectly honest, I don't like that reading as much. I think partially because of the setting. The setting, the way that Strauss said it, it does feel a bit religious. It does feel like it touches in a tad with something transcendental, more than just an old fling. It feels like it reaches past the veil into the grave. It feels a little bit more earnest. There's something slightly yucky about the opportunistic nature of using you know, All Souls Day as a chance to, like, I don't know, maybe it's like a booty call. I don't love that reading of it.
Yes, 100%.
But, you know, we're really confronted with, I think, the ritual of the day, of the time. Something feels familiar and comforting as we're invited into this setting. Come, let us set out the flowers and let us remember. We've talked about this before on the podcast, but May usually refers to young love, the blossoming of love, when romance was new. It's very evocative of that time period within a romantic relationship.
That makes sense.
It makes it, to me, a touch more poignant, well, I guess more than a touch, if you're speaking to a deceased partner, if you're remembering back. I think partially because that's one of my deep fears, is being at the end of my life and my partner, R.I.P. Yeah. Brian Sigich, my partner being gone, and all I have left are my memories
of
that sweet time of the May time of our lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really moving. It's really powerful. That reading is very potent. I can see the other one. It's not as potent. It doesn't.
Right?
It is. It's like poetic booty call.
Yeah,
look,
totally.
We're all like celebrating existence and thinking about life and death. And can we try again? Like,
Can we try again? Yes, yes. You know, I think the one thing that kind of gets me, I used to have a teacher who would say, just look at what's on the page. And I guess the thing that gets me about this page is that it does say, give me your hand to press in secret, you know, and if it ends up not remaining a secret, I do not care. To me, that does feel a little bit more something you would say to someone who's still here.
That's true.
But then in the next line, he says, give me but one of your sweet glances. The way that, and you'll see the way that that's set in the music and the harmonic shifting that we do really does feel like it brings us to another reality. Mm. And it doesn't just feel like a reality of, oh, maybe we could be together again. It feels like we catch a glimpse of a universe that's no longer available to us. Mm. So yeah, maybe let's go ahead and take a listen.
Sure.
The recording that we're going to hear was a long distance recording I made with a friend I met over Instagram. Her name is Lisa Davila. She's based in Northern California. We made this recording during COVID, so I was doing a lot of long distance things. Yeah.
That's great.
And I'm really excited for you to hear this. Also, she made this recording. We were working on this process not long after she lost her father.
Mm.
And it felt like important work. And it felt like very meaningful work that we did together. And I was very, very grateful for her being willing to step into this emotional space, considering what she had going on in her life.
Oh, I'm really looking forward to hearing this.
Thank you.
Wow. I have so many thoughts. I'm like exploding in my brain.
Let's hear them.
That was beautiful. I really enjoyed listening and like reading a lot, like the whole experience of that was beautiful. Knowing so many things, knowing more about Strauss, knowing about the poem, knowing about you and the singer and like all of the pieces, that is a really profound way to listen to music. while it was playing, I was trying really hard to have like two sides of my brain holding two different interpretations, right, yeah. Which was a little complex, but really fun to try to keep up with. And I think I am undecided. I can hear both because on one side, there's this idea of using All Souls Day to get back with someone.
Right.
And that way it feels like this grand gesture, very dramatic, mm-hmm. almost like flamboyant, like mm-hmm. so over the top, lots of convincing. Like if you're going to shoot your shot, you may as well be so over the top about it. And you get to the one part that you mentioned, that phrase,
give me your hand. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And yes, one more like, yes, sweet glance. Yeah.
Yes. And that all of that tension there with that interpretation is
right.
just like every ounce in my body needs to tell you that I want this. And it's so much almost drippy, like
yeah.
syrupy.
That's so interesting there because D major, so the piece is in, the song is in E flat and it modulates down, it shifts down to D major. And it's just so wildly removed. If
yeah.
you were to conceive of, oh, I'm going to make a song in E flat and maybe I'll modulate, like D major is not the key you think to go to. And I love that about it. It just kind of like drips into
yes.
it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Drips is exactly how that feels. So in that interpretation, it's just so big and like, this is my very last attempt, my very big shot into this chance.
You know, if I might interject here,
yeah.
I think that there is, I'm realizing as I'm sitting here and absorbing and chatting about it,
mm-hmm.
lots of times I just think about these things forever in my brain until I go insane. But I'm realizing I think that there is an element of earnest desire for connection. You know, when you realize, oh, life is short. I do have loved ones that have passed on. Let us not waste tomorrow. Let's connect. Let's be together, you know, before we too have passed through the veil. And that feels a little bit better to me than, as you said, the poetic booty call, which is, this is always forever going to be known as the poetic booty call song.
It will be.
There are so many songs that talk about sex. Like, Leader, it's dripping in sexual innuendo all over the place. And this was not one that I had previously really thought of in that way, but forever changed.
I think you're on the nose, though. I think with how big and dramatic it is, I think if I were to like go back and listen, I could really feel it. Because so that was that one side. And then on the other side, there was this grief. And it's powerful, and you can hear the grief in it, especially, I mean, the part we're just talking about, it just is like a meltdown. But overall, I think that kind of middle ground interpretation that you're talking about really combines the two and feels like, oh, that clicks in.
Right,
because you are holding, on one hand, you feel the earnestness, you feel the desperation almost.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
Then on the other hand, you feel these parts that are so deep and have so much gravity. And so it doesn't really feel like the whole thing is extraordinarily sad. And so I think that you nailed it.
It's funny because, and this often happens with song performance, I can feel one way about a poem and a song one day, and the next day feel a little bit differently about it. And I can foresee myself in the future having the option of performing it either way in my mind. You know, I really like to create, set up this whole internal world for each song that I perform. And I could see some days choosing this loved one still alive, some days choosing I'm speaking to my loved one who has passed before me. And I think with that interpretation, speaking to your deceased loved one, the part where he says, one day each year is devoted to the dead, come to my heart, komm an mein Herz, dass ich dich wieder habe wie einst in my, that we come to my heart and be mine again, as we once were in May. The piano part in that section, the piano bounds across the keyboard, and it reinforces this feeling of reaching across a great distance, a vast separation. I mean, sometimes when you're sitting at the piano, one end of the keyboard feels so very far from the other, depending on what technically is going on, right? And it feels like it crosses that vast expanse, physically, both physically and metaphorically. And I can see myself really latching on to that element in future performances when I choose that interpretation of the poem. So yeah, this has often been a favorite of mine. I think from the first time I heard it, I heard actually George Schulte and Kiri Takanawa, a recording, and I just remember dying inside a little bit in the car. I just... part of my heart kind of cracked off, and I, what's this now? I did not know I could feel such a thing. And I love returning to this one. For a while, it was technically scary for me. I've had to play it in multiple keys, and some keys are more challenging than others. But particularly even that part where it kind of bounds across the keyboard. I don't know, Strauss's piano writing is often very orchestral. For, I think, you know, the reasons that we discussed earlier, he just had that kind of imagination, and sometimes can feel like a lot to manage. It feels very thick and lush while at the same time often being fairly transparent, which is a weird dichotomy to just balance, to maintain.
That's a great point, yeah, being so... like complex, but really transparent. It's not overwhelmed with like big chunks of sound.
I've heard the critique before. Ah, this one book that I read was hilarious. It, about this song in particular, said it's essentially a big, heavy purple curtain, like purple, like drape curtain, like almost like you're suffocating. I've just never felt that. That's the funny thing about being involved in any kind of art and opinions on the art. You're going to find that one person thinks it's a big, heavy purple curtain under which you can't breathe.
That's hilarious.
And then another person thinks the completely opposite, you know?
Oh, that's so funny.
Yeah, so that, I think that probably wraps us up, unless you had any last comments that you wanted to say.
Well, the very last thing that stood out so heavily to me was your performance choice. The timing of that very last note made the entire song. I mean, like, it was such a journey, and then that last key, I was right with the timing of it. So it's really fun now to kind of break it down and being like, yes, I was feeling exactly that. And like that was perfect.
I love playing that like that because it's the little heart pang.
Yes.
Even when you've processed the big emotion, like the little pang is still there.
It was perfect. That's exactly how it came across. Yes.
Ah, well, thank you. Mm-hmm. Well, Janie, I honestly cannot thank you enough for being here today. I had so much fun.
I had so much fun, Mandy. I'm like going to be levitating, and someday I will come back down to earth, but this has been really a blast, and now I'm going to be looking at the world with new lenses today.
amazing. And listeners, thank you. If you haven't had enough Richard Strauss in your life, then you might want to try singing Alle Seelen with me. You can find my accompaniment on YouTube. I'm there as Mandy Madrid Sikic. Just click on the Leader Accompaniments playlist and start singing. I'll also include a link to it in the show notes. Remember that Follow the Leader can be found in all the usual podcasty places. And please, if you like what you hear, leave a review. It is truly the best way you can support the podcast. I mean, other than giving me $1 million. Follow the Leader is a production of Cincinnati Song Initiative. You can learn more about their network of podcasts at cincinnatisonginitiative.org/podcasts. You can also follow me on Instagram at LeaderNerd. That's at LeiderNerd. See you later, nerds!
If you love this podcast, then you'll love the Song Cycle podcast, also by Cincinnati Song Initiative. Song Cycle introduces the coolest and awesomest leaders of the song world today and dives into getting to know them and their unique stories, where they think song in the 21st century is headed, and lots of other great topics. If you're looking for your next source of inspiration as you continue on your own musical journey as a song lover, look no further than Song Cycle with me, your host, Sam Martin. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and join the conversation.